I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Decades after the civil rights movement of the 1960s, the racial divide in Kansas City remains. And when you look at some of the numbers regarding race, equity, and equality, there's been barely any advancement at all. Today, a look at the state of Black Kansas City, from income disparity to segregation in schools to the impact of inaccessible health care. Two leaders in the Black community outline what policy moves could help close the gap. Then, the other University of Kansas scandal that rocked collegiate sports. We'll examine the 2010 investigation involving tickets to KU basketball games that were hot in more ways than one. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The famed civil rights activist and author W.E.B. Du Bois once said the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. That color line remains oh so apparent in Kansas City, according to the 2019 State of Black Kansas City report from the Urban League of Greater Kansas City. The report, completed with help from the University of Missouri, Kansas City, shows that progress on a multitude of fronts, from economics to health to education and social justice, remains almost stagnant compared to previous years. African Americans in this town earn but 54% of what whites earn. The median net worth of households for blacks is only 10% of their white counterparts. And the poverty rate for African Americans is three times that the rate of whites. It's a jarring report. Here to talk about it are Gwen Grant. She's president and CEO of the Urban League of Greater Kansas City that commissioned this report. Gwen, always good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve.
Also with us, the Reverend Wallace Hartsfield. He's the pastor of the Metropolitan Missionary Baptist Church of Kansas City. Reverend Hartsfield, nice to have you back again, too.
Good morning.
Well, Gwen, this is a disturbing report. Just how disturbing is it?
Well, the report is disturbing in that African-American progress locally and across the nation has been slow to stagnant since we began measuring progress based on the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 as the starting line in our movement towards social and economic parity in this country. What we find is that across the board in education, economics, health, social justice, and civic engagement, with the exception of civic engagement, we are falling short of being equal or having an equal share of the American pie.
Yeah. People will wonder how you put this report together. How do you measure this notion of black progress compared to how their white counterparts are doing?
Well, the research methodology was established by the National Urban League in collaboration with a research entity called Global Insights. And the National Urban League established with these five quality of life indicators, they set up the process with whites being the control group and one being whole. As we compare blacks to whites in these areas, what percentage or what index value do you apply to African Americans in comparison to whites?
Reverend Hartsfield, I'm wondering how disturbing you find this report, given the fact that the progress appears to be so slow.
Well, I'm not sure that I would use the word disturbing as much as just frustrating. It's frustrating in the sense that we continue to move forward as if there is a real interest in this nation for equality and equity with regards to blacks to that of whites. And my thought would be is that if we at least go back to the Emancipation Proclamation, if not before that, but since the Emancipation Proclamation there in 1863 and forward, it's a shame to think that 150 years has brought us to the point where whites are still like a dollar, and we're 75 cents towards them. So it's more frustrating, and I think it says something about this nation, that this nation is not interested in the equality and the equity.
You know, I think a lot of people in this country, mainly white people, sort of assume that progress is occurring incrementally year after year after year. And again, what struck me about this report so strongly, Reverend, is that's not the case. It's right there in your face. The numbers are right there.
Well, I think there are good intentions. Definitely, I think that I'm not trying to suggest that persons are just there trying to hold all blacks down. I don't think that is the case. But I think there is such an apathy that exists within this nation, and there's the assumption that these things are going on, but somebody needs to know better.
Gwen Grant, and apathy, is that what's at the root of all this?
Well, you know, I think I agree with Reverend Hartsfield on his points, but I think in addition to that, I think the challenge is that far too few whites understand how we got to where we are. Mm-hmm. So you have to understand the systemic and structural impediments that have locked African Americans out of the economic framework of this country. So it goes back to understanding both federal and local policies with regard to redlining, and which was had major impact with preventing African Americans from home ownership, which is a pathway to economic self-sufficiency in this country.
And that occurred in a major way right here
occurred,
in Kansas City.
Yes. So we talk about it here in Kansas City, but it's also national. It was the federal policies dictated how redlining was applied in metropolitan areas across the country. So we have to understand that that is the contributing factor to the pervasive and long-term impact of this economic divide.
But why is grabbing a hold of that history so difficult? Why isn't that more commonly known and understood?
Well, because because it's really not taught in our schools. And certainly if you're white in America, you have an advantage that allows you to not, you don't even have to be aware. Mm-hmm. So you can go through your life pretty much without having to address the issue of race in this country, and without having exposure to that in your schools, you know, people just are not aware.
You know, you write in the preface here that all of this was made worse by the 2016 election, which you say resulted in, and I'm quoting here, seismic negative shift in race relations in this country. How is that manifesting itself here in Kansas City and, for that matter, across the country?
I think, you know, you just have to pay attention to the fact that hate crimes are on the rise, that if we look at the local level, we look at racial profiling, the Missouri Attorney General's report around the traffic stops, African Americans are now 91% more likely to be stopped while driving compared to their white counterparts. And that is a significant increase over previous years. You can't, you know, deny the you know, overlook the issue of poverty in this situation, economic policies with regard to access to health care. Mm-hmm. You see the rollback under this administration in all of those areas of, you know, civil rights, women's rights are, you know, are under assault, voting rights. So these are really trying times.
Yeah. To what extent does that strike you as also the case, Reverend Hartsfield, that the 2016 election was a dividing line of sorts in this country?
I would tend to agree, and I just think that one has to just look at the different movements, what has taken place since 2016, and I think that one can't help but note that we have some real problems. When you talk about racism, I mean, racism is there in a big way, and somehow until we come to address that matter, I think that we are just kind of playing with this.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking this morning about a new report from the Urban League of Greater Kansas City. It's a report that looks at economic and social political progress by African Americans in Kansas City. Gwen, do you do this report every year?
Well, we do it. Typically, we do it about every 2 to 3 years.
Okay. And the report is used how?
So we use this report first and foremost to educate and inform the community about the issues and how much progress or the lack thereof that African Americans have made in these areas. But we use it to drive policy, to educate and inform policymakers, elected officials, to serve as a platform or a foundation for dialogue and debate to understand these issues. But we also make recommendations on how to mitigate the challenges that we find in these areas.
The report is available on your website. It's also in book form, and people can get the book how?
Well, by attending one of the forums. If we have a public forum, we tend to distribute books at those forums, or they can download it from our website at ulkc.org or call our office and request a complimentary copy.
You know, just a few minutes ago, you mentioned this notion, Gwen, of racial profiling by police. And yet, according to the Missouri Attorney General's 2018 report on this subject, and you point this out in the report, blacks were 91% more likely than whites to be stopped by law enforcement, as you mentioned. In a perfect world, that number is zero. Do I have that right?
Yeah. I mean, so the police have to do their job, but certainly there's a problem when we are 91% more likely to be stopped just for driving while black, when white drivers have a higher contraband hit rate when they are stopped. So if crime prevention is important, then you would think that there would be some way to mitigate this challenge. And you cannot deny the fact that race is a factor. Now, the police will always say, well, no, there was some reasonable justification for the stop, but it just doesn't bear out.
It helped me here because I thought after Ferguson a few years ago that Missouri and lawmakers sort of took a look at this issue and tried to find a solution to lower that number. But your report says that ain't happening.
No. I mean, yeah. I think the challenge is, and the recommendation that we make is that the law which requires Attorney General's office to produce the report and requires local law enforcement jurisdictions in the state to report their stops. The law stops there. It's just a report. There are no consequences for law enforcement agencies with high rates of racial profiling. There are no consequences. They just turn in the report. They publish the report every year, and then they go back to business as usual. But so something needs to be done to hold law enforcement entities accountable.
And can I just say something
real
quickly
there?
I mean, I think when we talk about profiling, I think we need to put out here profiling, but we also need to put out here stereotyping. And there has been a lot of stereotyping that has been done up under the guise, supposedly, of profiling. And this is where we have a real problem. I'm in agreement with what Ms. Grant was saying, that we know the police have to do their job, but some of this is not based upon credible stops. This has to do more so with the assumption of who black folks are, you know, and especially when you talk about young black males and how they tend to be stereotyped, not profiled.
To what extent do your members of your congregation talk about this? Before we race past this finding, how big an issue is this in your community?
Well, I mean, this is a just kind of a natural part of the fabric of things. I mean, we don't necessarily stop and talk about it as a formal issue because it comes up so naturally and it comes up regularly. So, yes, I mean, it's an issue.
Another finding from this report, Gwen, that really I found to be just stop me. The goal of so many people of any color is to achieve economic self-reliance. And yet the numbers in this report suggest how difficult that is to achieve. Get this, the median net worth of black households in this community is only $17,600 compared to $171,000 for white households. I mean, that's the entire Kansas City metro we're talking about here,
yes,
right?
Yes, it is.
That's a staggering finding again.
It's a very troubling finding.
Yeah.
And it goes back to what I said earlier about the systemic structural challenges we have relative to economics. And one of the observations that I've made over the years is that, you know, when we look at education and economics, health, social justice, and civic engagement, and we've always been told, as I was coming up and as most African Americans, is that, you know, you just need to get an education. Mm-hmm. You need to have training and you need to have skills, and then you will have all these opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
But our data just don't bear that out, because we have achieved far more progress in the area of education than we have in economics.
Mm-hmm.
So there are other issues. These systemic and structural barriers have to be removed in order for us to have full access to the economic framework in this country.
Systemic,
so that means we have to look at how our lending institutions function, what's happening in, you know, in terms of home ownership. We do not have the equal access to loans. The loan denial rates for African Americans is much higher, be they for owning a home or for starting a business. So these things are very critical, and we need to do a lot more work on economics so that we can try to bridge that gap.
You know, Reverend Hartsfield, I want you to react to this too. The median net worth for black households, just to repeat, $17,600. For white households, $171,000. Again, what do you make of it?
Well, I mean, I think that there are three things that I would consider looking at as it relates to blacks and moving towards this piece that we call equality, and that is control of land, labor, and capital.
Mm.
And the bottom line has been is that blacks have really never been given a fair opportunity to acquire and control land. And not only that, as far as labor goes, we have not been really in charge of that. And so we are at the whim of others there. And then just capital. Being able to have what's needed to leverage and to even develop more capital.
Mm-hmm.
So even when we talk about this report, which to me, I mean, I may be oversimplifying it, but essentially if whites represent 100% and blacks are right there around 72-74%,
mm-hmm.
I mean, again, I go back. Whites are worth a dollar. Blacks are worth 75 cents. But whites have the ability to get access to lending institutions to leverage and to make more on the dollar, whereas 75 cents that we're worth, we don't have that kind of access.
Yeah.
So it's almost as if we remain static.
You know, Gwen, these numbers, and again, you refer to these systemic barriers that are out there, but these suggest that those barriers are tall and broad and big, and you just don't hear anybody really pointing directly at these things and saying we need not just modifications here, but big change to change these numbers.
Yeah, we do need big change. I will say, though, that we are starting to see more focus on equity in our civic community. So the Civic Council and the Kansas City Chamber both are now participating in dialogue sessions, working to understand race and equity,
right,
and to begin to rethink how they do business. So at least I think we're making progress in that regard. Is first you have to understand the problem,
mm-hmm,
before you can solve it. So if you don't understand that these barriers are systemic and that race is a problem, and that you don't, and if you think that we actually do live in a meritocracy and white people don't have an advantage, then it will be very difficult for you to sit down and figure out how do we arrive at new policies and practices that begin to provide for equitable access to the economic framework in Kansas City.
And some folks might say the election of Quentin Lucas might be one more sign, one more piece of evidence of a community beginning to grapple with these issues in a way that you're suggesting.
Some might say that, but, you know, I think I referenced, if not in this publication, in one of our prior publications, that for the greater Kansas City area, we've done really well at electing people of color to represent us. I mean, we just elected our third black mayor.
That's right.
We've had consistently the superintendent for KC Public Schools and other local school districts are African-American. We've had an African-American police chief. I mean, so if you look at, we have folks serving in the state legislature. We have Congressman Cleaver representing us on Capitol Hill. So you can look at that and say, okay, yeah, we've made some progress in who we elect to serve, but our policies, our systems are designed not to produce the outcomes that we want. And so in addition to electing someone like a Quentin Lucas or an Emmanuel Cleaver to represent us, we've got to look down at what are these systems that were put in place to deny us access. They were intentionally put in place to lock us out. Mm-hmm. And if we want to get out of this and to see something different, we're going to have to be very intentional about addressing policies.
The state of Black Kansas City is our topic here this morning, a new report from the Urban League of Greater Kansas City. When it comes to the schools in the Kansas City School District, only 10% of students are white, your report says. This comes years after the desegregation push in the district. And again, you can't help but shake your head, Reverend Hartsfield. 10% of the students in the district are white. That begins to speak to the severe segregation that still manifests itself in Kansas City.
Well, I think the late 60s and early 70s says everything. I mean, it was clear that even though policy was put in place to try to change what was going on with regards to education, whites didn't want their kids to learn with blacks. There was a mass exodus from the city, and even the policymakers helped that to happen with the creation of roads like 71 to get out into an area that could ultimately become suburbs. Mm-hmm. And now I just fear and I just pray that we don't repeat the same thing with regards to gentrification that is going to take place in the city, and will it end up being the same kind of thing where we have concentrated areas where blacks are going to be, concentrated areas where whites are going to be, and in those concentrated areas where blacks are, there's a lack of resource.
Right.
Right. So I, no, it does not surprise me. I just think that the mass exodus says everything, and it still says the same thing in that there is not a real push for our kids to be able to go to school together.
I want to get to a couple of more areas that your report cites, Gwen, in the minutes we have left here. When it comes to health care, you found some major problems in the fetal death rate, in the age-adjusted death rate. Mm-hmm. Just in general, what did you find there, Gwen? Because one finding was the age-adjusted death rate deteriorated substantially since 2015.
Well, we believe that that particular finding has to do with the access to care issue and the rollback on Obamacare. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have access to insurance, then just your ability to better take care of your health is certainly at risk. With the fetal death rate amongst African American women, that has been attributed to some of the other quality of life indicators, such as the economics. Living in poverty, living in highly distressed communities, weighs heavily on women's reproductive health. Mm-hmm. And so those issues are certainly of great concern in this report. But I think the biggest thing what we want to express here is that access to care is critically important, and it still takes us back to the economic divide. Because when you have access to money, when you have capital, then you can acquire, you can get a better education, you can get access to quality health care. I mean, you know, it's just across the board. It's a very critical piece that we must address.
One more finding I wanted to get to in the area of education. You raised big questions about classes taught by highly qualified teachers, and you found that blacks were far on the short end on that scale. What did you find there?
So basically, we found that only about, I think it's 38% of black children in urban districts are taught by highly qualified teachers, mm-hmm. Compared to students. And the comparison, and, you know, I don't want to get into the weeds of the research methodology here. It would put everyone to sleep. But basically, in this particular study, they compared Kansas City public schools, they compared urban schools to a couple of suburban schools. So in that comparison, you found that 38% of students in urban school districts, only 38% have access to a high quality teacher. And then while all students in those suburban districts have access to high-quality teaching.
And obviously the teacher in the classroom, a critical component of any child's education.
Very critical. Here. Research bears out that teacher quality is one of the number one indicators of student success. And when we talk about teacher quality, we're talking about teacher preparation. Do they have a master's degree? And are they, do they have a degree in the subject matter that they're teaching? And then how much classroom experience do they have?
The state of black Kansas City, that's been our topic here. I want to thank our guests, as always, Gwen Grant, President and CEO of the Urban League of Greater Kansas City, the Reverend Wallace Hartsfield, pastor of the Metropolitan Missionary Baptist Church of Kansas City. This report is available on the Urban League's website, easy to find there if you click on it. Thank you both for a very good conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having
me,
Steve.
Thank you.
Coming up, the other million-dollar brouhaha at the University of Kansas Department of Athletics, this one involving illegal tickets to football and basketball games from a few years ago, with that money ending up in the pockets of university employees. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Have you signed up for my newsletter? We'll send you one to your inbox each Monday. Just go to kcur.org/Kraske and register for Kraske Off Mic. Then you'll get my take on guests and topics as well as highlights from the show. Subscribe at kcur.org/Kraske. NPR coverage of impeachment hearings will likely preempt our program for the next few days, but we'll return later this week when the film critics give us their reviews of what's showing in local theaters. That's here on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the NCAA is investigating the University of Kansas and Coach Bill Self in a move that's generated lots of headlines and lots of concern among the Jayhawk faithful. But that's not the only investigation in recent years that's rocked the school. Back in 2010, Lawrence was stunned to learn that the FBI and IRS were on campus investigating a man named Rodney Jones for stealing Jayhawk basketball tickets and then selling them to brokers. Turns out that Jones was just one person involved. In all, seven members of the so-called Kansas Ticket Gang pleaded guilty to charges, and five wound up going to prison. All this had gone on for 5 years. Some called it the biggest scandal in college sports history, and many have never heard the story. George Fredrickson is a former distinguished public administration professor at KU and a former president of Eastern Washington University who's written a new book about the scandal. It's titled Crimes, Championships, and Big Time Sports at the University of Kansas, and he joins me now from the Kansas Public Radio over in Lawrence. George, it's nice to have you. Welcome.
Good morning.
Can you make a case that this was the biggest scandal in college sports history?
No, I can't. What I will make is a case that it is the biggest having to do with finance.
Ah, okay. Why did you decide to take a deep dive in what happened here?
Well, I needed a project because I was retiring and I wanted to keep active and do something that I was interested in. And I have an interest in sports and in higher education and in true crime. And so I thought I would take a run at it. The 2010, when the scandal was in public view, was the same year that I retired. So the two came together.
So I was going to say all these things came together pretty nicely. And I can't help but wonder, how did KU react to you working on this book, George?
Well, very mixed. I said in the main, the athletic department was not that pleased, but it varied. The university itself was great in terms of you're a faculty member and you have the right to do whatever in your profession is appropriate. And so I never received any discouragement or lack of interest. Most everyone was encouraging, even among the people in the athletic department.
How cooperative were they, George?
Some were very cooperative, and some were just indifferent. And a few let me know of their opposition to the idea, but most were fine.
You know, this scandal endured for more than 5 years. You know, some folks are going to wonder, how in the world was that even possible?
Well, looking back now, it is difficult. It was a matter partly of luck. It came together because of a unique bunch of circumstances, and so it was. There were elements of randomness in terms of why it happened, and there are elements of luck that it wasn't discovered much sooner.
We're talking about the KU ticket scandal from a few years ago. If it went on for as long as it did here at KU, George, and there was so much money involved potentially here, you can't help but wonder why other colleges and universities haven't faced a similar scandal, or have there been other scandals and I'm just not aware of it?
It's the latter. None as big as KU, but many universities have had one or two employees who hustled tickets, some of them for quite a bit of money. In such systems, there's a good bit of slack in their operations, and the size of this slack or the amount of it can amount to quite a bit. But there has been, this has hung around for a long time. Wherever there's money, there are always risks.
Mm-hmm. Just give us the broad outlines here, George, if you would. How did the KU ticket scandal work?
Well, two of the reasons were the tickets were held by the ticket office.
Mm-hmm.
And the ticket office, by the rules and bylaws of the ticket department, the athletic department, was charged with selling the tickets, making arrangements for who has what seats, seating those who buy tickets. And several of these activities required people who could be trusted with money.
Mm-hmm.
And so each of them was to have been vetted when employed, and their work was to be audited, and they must keep accounts of all money. But there's no particular professional training for ticket management. It's a thing that you learn while doing, and some learn very well from good examples and good leaders.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, others learn from unreliable, dishonest
right
people. And what they learn is to steal and sell to brokers. And that's what happened here. We had a couple of pretty dishonest staffers who groomed and reached out and involved others until finally it became seven people. And it went on for a long time.
I was really struck just at one point how loose things were over there. One of the central players I mentioned in the opening, Rodney Jones, I believe there's an anecdote in the book. I'm trying to recall my reading here. His first day on the job, he's actually, you know, he'd been employed for a day, sort of hired on the recommendations of Danny Manning, I believe. And at the end of a football game, he's handed a bag with thousands of dollars of cash and told to go deposit it or transport it somewhere. And people hardly knew who this guy was.
That's exactly correct.
What did you make of that?
He wasn't bonded. Well, when I heard it, I was astonished. So I checked it and verified it, and it did. They hired him without checking very much about him. He wasn't bonded, and that's usually how an organization protects itself from this kind of crime. So it was an astonishing beginning for his work at the ticket office.
You know, tell me about Rodney Jones. Who was he? I mentioned he was close to KU basketball legend Danny Manning, but he's a central player here. Tell us who Rodney Jones is.
Born and raised in the Midwest in Missouri. Baseball player. I tried to play baseball in junior college. Didn't succeed. Went to the Coast Guard and was 6 years in the Coast Guard, honorably discharged, and was, as far as we know, an honest and good sailor.
Mm-hmm.
He then went to the University of Oklahoma to get his bachelor's degree. And while he was, before he was there, he was living in Topeka.
Mm-hmm.
And he was playing softball. And on his softball team was Danny Manning, who was, I didn't know he was a softball player. But the two of them became friends, and when Rodney finally graduated from the University of Oklahoma, he came to KU and got together with his friend and said he and his wife wanted to live in Lawrence and make their lives here, and he needed a job at the university, and Danny helped him, and where he found his job was in the ticket office.
Hmm. We're talking about the KU ticket scandal from 2010, the book that George Fredrickson has written here, Crimes, Championships, and Big-Time Sports at the University of Kansas. Another key player here, Charlotte Blubaugh. Tell us about her.
Well, Charlotte Blubaugh was raised in Oklahoma, was married at a young age, went to the University of Oklahoma. Got a part-time job, as many students do. It was in the athletic department in the cafeteria where she started. She worked her way up and was involved with one of the first computers that was used in the athletic department, and she was sort of self-taught in terms of computing. And turns out she was very good at that, had a lot of talent, and got to learn programming and such. She ended up working in the ticket office of athletic sports at Oklahoma, and she worked her way up there, coming to be one of the two assistant directors of the ticket office at Oklahoma. she then saw got a call from her boss, a man named Tom Blubaugh. Her name at the time was Charlotte Stewart. She went to work in Tom Blubaugh's ticket office. He was the director.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know what she may or may not have done at the University of Oklahoma. There was not an investigation there.
Mm.
Blubaugh got called by Randy Jones. Jones was looking for an assistant director for the ticket office, which he was then managing. And Lou Perkins and he agreed to go after somebody. And he called his friend Tom Blubaugh. Would Tom have anybody to suggest? Blubaugh suggested Charlotte Stewart. She was hired, and when she showed up, within 2 months after she was hired, she showed up with Tom Blubaugh, mm-hmm. who left the University of Oklahoma overnight and came to Kansas. Charlotte had a job. The two married, and then the processes of grooming others to learn how to hide the tickets, hide the records of the tickets, and steal them and get them to brokers began. And Jones was already doing some of that. So Jones and Blubaugh hooked up, and it eventuated to be seven people, five of whom went to prison, and two were given probation.
The book again, Hot Tickets, Crimes, Championships, and Big Time Sports at the University of Kansas. You know, one issue you found with Charlotte Blubaugh, she was the expert at the computer program that manipulated and handled these tickets. You found, George, that her home life may have contributed to her actions at the ticket office. How so?
Well, she loved her work. She was particularly loyal. She was friendly, lively, humorous, enjoyed being around others, and others enjoyed being around her. She liked being home. By then, she had two children. They were in their preteen years, and she found that less interesting. And I started reading the literature about that, and there's a whole literature about how women who have both full-time work and are raising children sometimes find it more comfortable and relaxing to be at work than to be at home. And it turns out that this was, I think, in part an explanation of why she was as ambitious and driven as she was.
You found that she took terrible chances that made it almost inevitable that she was going to get caught. Explain that. What kind of terrible chances are you talking about?
Well, being caught. And the logic of doing it is to steal a ticket that costs $100, which is about an average cost of one seat in one game. And the logic is that you have to put $100 back into the accounting system or someone will be aware that it was stolen.
Mm-hmm.
So you put $100 back, but if you can sell that ticket for $150, you can keep the $50.
Ah.
And so that was the way they worked, she working with the other six. And then she got so confident of herself, of hiding tickets in files. These are computer files. And then she started taking all the money. So if she had a ticket worth $100, she sold it to a broker for $150, and she kept $150, rather than 100. And so
a track was being, that's really putting her vulnerable at getting caught at some point by doing it that way then, based on what you said.
A decent auditor might have figured it out, although she did such a good job, it was tough to figure out. But they did.
Mm-hmm.
And but they did because she was ratted out by her fellow gang members.
Mm-hmm.
But she got away with it. So that meant that there were tickets often in the 50 to 60 a game range,
mm-hmm.
For which the university received no money at all.
To what extent was dissatisfaction with their pay a motivator here for people to get involved?
Well, that was an excuse or an explanation or mm-hmm. a rationale
mm-hmm.
Used by Charlotte and by the others, that they were poorly paid and
Were they poorly paid?
Well, yes. The director of the ticket office, I think, made less than 70 to 80,000,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And by 2010, it was probably 90, maybe 100,000. That would be the director, and you don't get top junior professionals for that little money.
They see all this money washing around the system, all these tickets flying around, and they think, hey, it's not that big of a leap to say, I want a piece of that action then, right?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And what she would do would give junior staff members packets of tickets, season tickets for whole seasons.
Mm-hmm.
She would give them 4 or 6 of those, and say, I can't give you a bonus or a Christmas bonus, but I can give you these tickets, and you're welcome to go sell them to be as if I was giving you a raise. And so it started with 4,
mm-hmm.
four packages of season tickets, then 8, and so on.
How was the scandal finally discovered, George? I've got like 30 seconds left here.
A guy named Tom Freeman, a local thug, was caught bribing an official in Junction City and was convicted. And in his conviction, he was trying to get his plea reduced.
Mm-hmm.
So he ratted out his friend Rodney Jones.
Could this happen again at KU?
No. They've cleaned up their act. They did a good job. They did a poor job on the run-up to the scandal, which made the scandal possible. But they're doing a great job. They went to school and did what the right thing. And I think a lot of other universities watching what KU did also went to school on it.
Right. That's George Fredrickson, his new book, Hot Tickets, Crimes, Championships, and Big Time Sports at the University of Kansas. He joined me this morning from Kansas Public Radio over in Lawrence. George, it was nice to have you. Thanks for the update. I sure appreciate it.
Rock shock.
You bet. Last week on Up to Date, the Kansas City Municipal Court is asking residents for input to improve the judicial experience. Hear what they hope to learn at kcur.org/uptodate. Throughout the week, KCUR will air NPR coverage of the impeachment inquiry hearings. Join me Friday to get reviews from our film critics here on Up to Date. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.